We're in Uyj YC, Shir on the Parsha, on Parshat Ki Tisa. The clear, biggest event of the Parsha is Chet HaEgel. Chet HaEgel is something that in many different forums we together have learned and we've studied and we've discussed together. Last year in Shir Kali, in the winter Midrashah, in the Midrashah itself. So we've gone over kind of that essential piece of what went wrong with Chet HaEgel. What I'd like to do today is to recap some of those key points to create a foundation. And I actually want to take it one step further and answer a question that we have not necessarily answered in the past. It's going to go into some delicate issues, some really important issues, and some issues that I think, even though they may not necessarily be relevant to everybody right now in this stage of life, will Bezrat Hashem be relevant to everyone. And so we're going to lay those foundations down, and I hope that you'll hold these ideas with you along the way. In terms of the flow of Sefer Shmot, and we keep coming back to this because it's the overall narrative in which everything in Sefer Shmot has to fall into, what were our three tent poles? What were our three key stations in Sefer Shmot? Three main topics of the book.
Yeah.
There we go. Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Good. Matan Torah. Matan Torah. And then the Mishkan. And we've discussed in previous shiurim that this flow of clearly Yitzhak Mitzrayim to Matan Torah to the Mishkan, that what this is doing is creating a reality, it's creating a paradigm for our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with our relationship with Hashem, which is the paradigmatic relationship, the ultimate relationship. And the relationship that we have down here that mirrors that ultimate relationship is the relationship between the ultimate relationship in Olam Hazeh, husband and wife. We need to go over that. We can do a different shiur. That is the ultimate relationship in Olam Hazeh, is the relationship between a husband and a wife. Okay? And that's paralleling each stage in this process, which again, we've also talked about in previous shiurim. That Yitzhak Mitzrayim, I'm not going to go through all of the proofs for this now, but that Yitzhak Mitzrayim is the process of where we meet a Kadosh Baruch Hu, where a Kadosh Baruch Hu exposes himself, so to speak, not exposes, he reveals himself is a much better, and especially in the context of this conversation, is a much better term. He reveals himself to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. He reveals himself to Bnei Yisrael. We get to know him. We realize who a Kadosh Baruch Hu is. We decide that we want to be his nation, that he wants us as his people. We march our way to Matan Torah. Matan Torah, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifts the mountain up over our heads as he hands us the Torah itself. And in previous shiurim, what have we likened that to? The chuppah, right? Often we focus on the negative side of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced us to accept the Torah. But there's other imagery of that as well, some very beautiful imagery of that as well. He took a whole mountain, held it over our heads in the most beautiful chuppah in all of history. This beautiful, gorgeous, adorned, flowered mountain. And held it over our heads as an amazing chuppah. And what's the key thing that needs to be given over under that chuppah? The ketubah. It's really the ring, that's true. But he gives over the ketubah. And the ketubah is the Torah. We receive the document that binds us together, the contract that binds us together with the Kadosh Baruch Hu for all of eternity. And that's reflected in Chazal. This is not just from the obvious nature of the story, but it also comes out through Chazal. Based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, source number one, B'yom Chatunato, it refers to in Shir HaShirim the day of the wedding, Zeh Matan Torah. Matan Torah is, according to Chazal, the same Chazal that talked about Kofin Alim Harkigit, that Kadosh Baruch Hu held the mountain overhead and forced us to accept the Torah, the same Chazal from a different perspective. Understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is holding that mountain over our heads as a chuppah, and we're entering into a relationship of marriage with the Kadosh Baruch Hu and Matan Torah. It's the marriage between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. And also, as we talked about in the past, that seemingly should then be the end of the story. But in Judaism, that's not where the story ends. There's one last stage, the stage of the Mishkan. What is the goal of the Mishkan? What do we need to do then after the chuppah? What is then the whole work of life together in a marriage? To create, if you will, a bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael. The same thing that we have a bracha to a chatan mekala. To create a bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael. We have to build that bayit together. We have to build that home. And so we go and we build the Mishkan, the ultimate fulfillment of Matan Torah, as we've talked about this year in Shir Kali. The ultimate fulfillment of Matan Torah is to create that bayit, is to create that bayit, and that mommy saw that home. And in the course of the process of a marriage, we meet that person, we get to know them, We finally reach the stage of chuppah, and then the whole rest of life is building that bayit ne'aman b'Yisrael. That's the goal. And that's why if you look at the pasuk in source number 1, same thing with Shir HaShirim, it talks about Yom Chatunato, the day of the wedding, and then Yom Simchat Libo, then the day of joy that somehow comes after the wedding. What's this day of joy? So the Chazal understand as of Yom Simchat Libo, Ze Binyan Beit HaMikdash, Shibana B'mehera B'yameinu. Right? That's the goal. They understand that the next stage after Yom Chatunato is Yom Simchat Libo, the day of joy, the day of happiness, which is the building of the Beit HaMikdash, that's big picture, and then each of our lives, that's the building of that Bayit Ne'aman B'Yisrael, that's right there in Chazal. That's the goal. That's the arc. This parsha posed a problem for me in that arc for years. And normally when I give over the whole shir of the synopsis that I just shared with you, some of you have heard before, I'm always very happy that by the time we go through all of the details of that shir, we kind of run out of time toward the Mishkan piece, and I can ignore one really important element, which is that there aren't four parshiot of building the Mishkan. There are five parshiot in the context of building the Mishkan. We have Truma, where we're commanded on how we're supposed to build the Mishkan. Tetzava, we're commanded on how we're supposed to build the Big Day Kahuna. Vayakhel, where we actually build the Mishkan. The Kudi, where we actually build the Big Day Kahuna and everything comes together. Ukvod Hashem Aleit HaMishkan, and the Mishkan comes and is up and running and is gorgeous and is beautiful and is functioning. But what happens in the middle? It's called this week's Parsha. Parsha Kitisa. I skipped over it. Did anybody miss that? This is this week's Parsha. Kitisa. Yes. Kitisa. Chita Egel somehow in the middle of that? Where we see Moshe go up to the mountain for 40 days. We don't, it doesn't come back down in time. We're worried something happens and we do Avodah Zarah? We build an Egel Azaha? How is that in the middle of these parshiot? How does that fit into this narrative? How does Chet Egel fit into the process of getting to do a marriage with the Kadosh Baruch Hu or getting into a marriage in life? How does that possibly fit in? And even when there are hints to how it fits in, they're incredibly troublesome. If you take a look at the beginning of next week's Parsha, Parsha Pekudei, source number 3. Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, Mishkan HaYidut. These are the countings of the Mishkan of testimony. Testifying to what? What Rashi asks, what is the Mishkan testifying to? Next week's Parsha. Source number 4, Rashi says, Mishkan ha'idut, Eidut li'Yisrael shivatir lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu al ma'aseh ha'igel. That this is a testimony that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgave them for Chet HaEgel. What's the problem with the Mishkan being a testimony that they're forgiven for Chet HaEgel? They had it beforehand. We had Truma and Tetzaveh. Then Kitisa, then Vayakha B'Kudei. If you would have had it be that Kitisa came first, that Chet HaEgel came first, and then we had the building of the Mishkan, that Rashi, that Chazal would make sense. But how do you understand that? I still wouldn't understand why he's there at all. But at least there's somehow some chronology going on. But the Torah sets it up. Truma Tetzaveh. In theory, what should the Mishkan be? What is the ideal of the Mishkan? Then Kitisa. Then we actually build the Mishkan. But the Mishkan ends up being retroactively a kapara for Chet HaEgel. The whole narrative seems to be lost with this one parsha. So we're going to try to reassert that narrative. And it's going to, again, bring forward some challenging aspects of what marriage is about. And again, while most people in the room are not necessarily up to that stage right now, I think there are important things to learn in the context of the Torah, because we have to learn the Torah as it is, and also to carry with us, because these things are important concepts as we go along this process to getting to marriage and building the Bayit Ne'aman B'Yisrael. These are key aspects in that process. It's got a lot of ground to cover. Let's do this. What happens in Chet HaEgel? Source number 5 from our parasha. Vayara am ki boshesh Moshe l'aretz min ahar. The nation sees that Moshe delayed in coming down from the mountain. Vayikahela am al Aaron, and the nation comes and attacks Aaron. Vayaru elav and say to him, Kuma selanu Elohim asher yilchu lefaneinu. Make a god for us that will walk before us. Ki ze Moshe ha'ish asher ha'alanu mi'eretz Mitzrayim lo yadanu me'alo. We don't know what happened to Moshe. Moshe said he was going to go up for 40 days, come down, and then he was going to come and give us the Torah. We find he's late. For some reason, they now assume that everything has gone wrong. Understand that? Why does he assume that everything has gone wrong? Just because he's a little bit late? He didn't come down yet? And therefore, because of that, we need to create some sort of image of God? Because you know what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu. Skipping down, the underline, Simon, they get to a point where they build the ego, and they say, this is the God of Israel. This is your God, Israel. Who took you out of Egypt.
What happened there? What was going on?
Now again, we're not dealing with this shir either, of what happened in the Chetek. We did that last year. Again, quick synopsis of the bottom line point of that shiur.
What was happening there? How could they have done...
The fundamental question, the most basic question asked in this week's Parsha, which is why we did it last year. The most basic question in this week's Parsha. Which is, how is it possible that after seeing Yetziat Mitzrayim at Kriyat Yamsuf, and then Matan Torah, where God said explicitly, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim, I am Hashem your God. And then next phrase, Lo Yeh Lecha Elohim Acherim Al Panai. Don't serve idols. 40 days later, they build an egel? This generation, the Dor De'ah, the Dor that saw, this generation that was on such a lofty plane, they do Chet HaEgel? They build an idol? How is that possible? There's so many questions to tackle in this Parsha. It's a challenging challenge, so many challenges in this Parsha. One aspect of what this is about is just to try to get into the heads of Bnei Yisrael, and you could listen to last year's Shir Kali for more in-depth on this concept. But let's again say it in short. What happened? Think about it from Bnei Yisrael's perspective. Bnei Yisrael, when they meet God, when God again reveals himself to Bnei Yisrael for the first time, what is he actually doing? Beginning of Sefer Shemot, what is he doing? Not when he reveals himself to Moshe.
Killing the Mitzrayim.
He's what?
Killing the Mitzrayim.
He's killing the Mitzrayim. I'll say it even harsher than that. He is decimating, beat by beat, over 10 stages, the greatest world power. He is a frightening God. He is a destructive God. He is a vengeful God. There's a frightening image of God as water turns to blood, as boil starts to spill over, as animals die, as locusts eat all the food, as fiery hail comes down from the sky, and then last but not least, by any stretch of the imagination, in every single house, a firstborn child dies. That's really scary. That gives me an image of a God of Din. I do wrong and I better watch out because God is going to react in kind. I then walk out of Egypt and a few days later I get stuck at Yam Suf, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu does a miracle for me. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do for us? He splits the sea. But then what does he do to the people he doesn't like? He has to come crashing down on their heads and we watch their dead bodies float up on the shore. I'm painting a different picture of Yetziat Mitzrayim, but look at it from that perspective, from Bnei Yisrael. They then come to Har Sinai. And as we talked about, it's the day of a chuppah. It's an amazing day. It's a wonderful day. It's a beautiful day. But let's look at it from the other side, if you want to see it from a different perspective. We talked about this in Bibi Shirim. God says Anochi, and the second he says Anochi, it's just an overpowering experience that our souls fly out of our bodies. And Chazal tells us that when that happens, the angels have to come and push our souls back into our bodies. And then it happens for every single word for the first two Dibrot. We die a lot during Matan Torah, if you want to phrase it that way. And perhaps what we build up is this very frightening image of God. God begs us not to see it that way. Moshe begs us not to see it that way. God also splits the sea for us and takes us out of Mitzrayim and gives us the Man and the Be'er and the Esh and the Anan and that gives us the Torah. Meaning there's all this other stuff too. We could paint two very different pictures. But if one wanted to, one could imagine, one could envision God as being a very frightening God. And to put it in a term, a very specific term which we used before, we could see God as a God of Din. God as a God of judgment. You reap what you sow, no more and no less. And wouldn't you know it, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to the mountain. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'll be back in 40 days. So you know what I do the minute Moshe Rabbeinu says I'm going to be back in 40 days? I'm going to set my watch. I don't know what's going to happen up there. I can't see it. I don't know what's happening up there. He went up. He disappeared. I hope everything goes okay, because if not, it's probably not coming down. And Moshe Rabbeinu is a little bit late in their minds because they're so frightened. And so what do they immediately assume? Something went wrong. Moshe's dead. New plan.
and they need something to help them out, so they go. And they don't actually build an eagle. Chazal tell us that they didn't actually build an eagle. That Aaron took all of that gold and he threw it into a fire, and out emerged an eagle, a baby calf, baby ox. What does an ox do? What does an ox literally do when you're out there in an agricultural reality? What does an ox do?
Pulls things.
What is it primarily pulling in an agricultural society?
A cart.
Plow. Or plow. What? Or a plow. Yeah, which way you were going. That's what you used to sow. You use a cart, you use a plow, right? It's pulling a plow. An ox is what works and works and works to create the potential to plant. Because in life, you know what? You know the way life works? You reap what you sow. It's a world of deen, no more and no less. And so what's produced from that fire is the egel. And God says, if this is how you see me, I'll give you your image of who I am. And they served their own image of God. They served God as they saw him, which was an aspect of the reality of God, but was not God himself by any stretch of the imagination. It was a distorted perception of God. It's a distorted perception of God, which we still struggle with to this day. We're not going to go into all the details. In source number 6, it's an amazing Gemara, really a wild Gemara, where it talks about how the Yetzer for Avodah Zarah no longer exists. You can take a look inside on your own. What happens is they're like, okay, Avodah Zarah has cost us too much. We don't want the Avodah Zarah. We don't want the scar for overcoming it. Just get rid of it. And God says, okay. And the way that the Gemara phrases is that a fiery lion then jumps out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that's the image of the Yetzer Avodah Zarah, and they trap it in a box and they put it away. So there's a lot to unpack from that story. But the first one is where does the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah come from? Where does it jump out of? Bibeit? Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's not where I would have expected it to come from. The Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, why would it be there of all places? And the Gemara is telling us, be very careful. Because there is a very fine line between Avodat Hashem and Avodah Zarah. A very fine line. The two can emerge from the same place. The two emerge from our internal Kodesh HaKadoshim. There are many times where I can think that I'm serving God, but I'm really only serving my image of God, and that is quintessential Avodah Zarah. Is to serve the God that I imagine, is to serve the God who I wish him to be, which really is just serving myself. From the deepest chambers of myself can come either Avodah Zarah or Avodat Hashem. From the deepest chambers of the Mishkan can either come Avodah Zarah or Avodat Hashem. Am I serving my image of God or am I serving God himself? That's the fundamental question. And it's something which, again, we struggle with this day. Now, if the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah is gone, how is that severe? So I often suspect, and I never heard my Rebbe say this. I mean, my Rebbe never said this himself. When I was looking at this Gemara, which he quotes all the time, it was very interesting to me that it says that when the fiery lion jumps out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it says that one hair falls off from that lion before they trap it in that box. And I suspect that se'ar, the smallest shiur, that hair's breadth, is what stands between Avodat Hashem and Avodah Zarah. And while we don't bow down to idol city, we still struggle with the hair's breadth difference between Avodat Atzmecha, serving oneself, serving one's image of God, and serving Hashem as he really is. And we all have images of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that we've been given from childhood, that we've been built up from childhood. Unfortunately for many of us, we learn about God as a child, and then we get older, and then we have to learn real things. 20 years, real things. And we stop learning about God. We stop trying to understand God. And most of us, I don't even think, have built up necessarily a negative, distorted version of God. I think we're still, many of us are walking around with the image of God that were built up for us in kindergarten. And that's kind of limped along with us along the way. We've kind of added stuff to it, but we've never investigated it more because we don't learn about it, because we don't talk about it. What does it mean to have God in our lives? What does it mean to relate to an infinite being as a finite being? What does it mean that God is guiding us in this world? How does that work? What can we understand about God? How do we understand that? How does God interact with us? How does he guide us in this world? How does that all work? And we get so busy and lost in other things that we stop talking about the most fundamental question. Who is God? How do we understand that? And unless we address that question, we inevitably end up serving the image of God that we build up. And that's the fight against Avodah Zarah that resists to this day. It's why it still remains one of the big three. Avodah Zarah, Giloy Arayot, Shfichut Damim. It's still relevant because we're all fighting that image of God that we have in our hearts to really understand God for who he is. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu always puts the resolution for something before he brings up the problem. And there is an issue at the beginning of the parsha that really is the answer to this problem. Last year, Chloe, we talked about why is it that the Mizbeach HaZahav was at the end of Tetzav, and we had a whole shiur just on that. Why is it in the wrong place? Well, there's one more piece of the Mishkan that belonged in Truma, but we don't meet until this parsha. The opening of the parsha discusses the Kior. What's the Kior? Wash basin. Nobody's a good old school art school person. The lever. You know what a lever is. Right? The wash basin. The Kohanim would come in every single day and they would wash their hands and their feet before they would come to work. That's the beginning of the parsha, source number 7 on your sheets. Vasita kior nechoshet v'chanon nechoshet l'rachsa. V'natato tobin ol meidu v'na mizbeach v'natato shamamayim. Which we all know by heart, again, from Korbanot. Again, as we all say every day, it's the beginning of Korbanot. Because that's the first thing that we need to do. If we're even going to bring Korbanot with our words every day, we start with the kior. Why is the kior here? The kior should have been with all of the other kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, with all of the other kelim of the Mishkan, Parsha Truma. What's the essence? What is the kior about? The kior is emphasizing for us, which needs to be at the beginning of this Parsha because it reflects the mistake that we make. That when one comes to do Avodat Hashem, one walks in to the Mishkan, to the Beit HaMikdash, to do Avodat Hashem, we need to do something first. There is an action that we must take first. What do we have to do first? We have to come and wash away all of our preconceived notions, all of our misconceptions, wash all of it away to be able to see God and Avodat Hashem for what it actually is. The cure has to come first in the Avoda of the Mishkan and in our own daily lives. Every single morning, the first thing that we're supposed to do in the morning is run to go and wash our hands. The Mishnah Berurah on the spot there, in the beginning of Shulchan Aruch, says that one of the reasons why we're going and washing our hands is because just like the Kohanim, the first thing they would do when they came to the Mishkan, when they came to the Beit HaMikdash, was wash their hands. Every single morning we run to the sink, to our little mini kior in our little mini Beit HaMikdash, and we wash our hands, and we wash away, he doesn't say this, all of our preconceived notions, and then we raise up our hands, as he does say, we raise up our hands, and we dedicate our hands to serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the rest of the day. First thing we do is we wash away our sense of self. Mode ani lefanecha. I recognize that everything comes from you, everything is about you. I am mode before I say ani. Ani always comes second. I am always secondary to focusing on you, to thanking you, to focusing on what I could do for you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for giving me life, to serving you in this world. I wash my hands to wash away all of that sense of self, and to go forward and serve you for the rest of the day. So too by the Mishkan, and so too in this parsha, that's what's being emphasized first. That's the answer to the question before the question is even asked in Parshat Ki Tisa. What was this laver made out of? Everybody know what the cure was made out of? The wash basin? Copper. Where did that copper come from?
What was the mirrors of the...
Yes. It was the mirrors of the women. So Rashi quotes and expands on what you said as follows. Take a look in source number 8. The Pasuk says in Parshat Pekudei, Vayas et ha-kior nechoshet ve-charon nechoshet bermar'ot ha-tzov'ot, using the mirrors of the legions. Rashi's like, the mirrors of the legions, what is that? Where did that come from? Next page. The Ma'ot HaTzovot. As you said, Shira,
Rashi says, Benot Yisrael hayu biadan marot. The Benot Yisrael had these mirrors. Shiraot bahen kashayim mit kashtot. That they had when they would beautify themselves. As one does with a mirror. That's why everyone has a mirror, assumably. Ve'avotan lo achru mi lehavilen linvot ha-mishkan. Even these were not held back from giving to the Mishkan. Why would we presume that they would be held back from giving to the Mishkan? Because what do we want? If somebody is using, this is an object which is purely to upraise, to beautify my physical self. It's all about my physicality. It's all about my externality. Why would I want that in the Mishkan, which is all about internal service of God? And that's how Moshe sees it. Vayamoes Moshe Bahen. He was disgusted by them. He said, don't bring these mirrors. What are you doing? Because they're used for the Yitzhara. Because there are women out there who do this to beautify themselves in order to get to a place where they do sins. I don't want these. It's all about physicality. It's all about increasing physicality and tava in this world. I want no part of it. This should be in the Mishkan. Moshe says, add no way. God says, yes way. God says, absolutely. God says, there is nothing more that I want in this Mishkan. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kabel. God says, take those mirrors. Ki elu chavivin alai min hakol. They are more precious to me, says God, than anything else. Because it was through these that the women were able to produce children in Mitzrayim, says Rashi going forward. That the women realized that their husbands weren't going to have children with them anymore. Because Paro had decreed that all of the Jewish boys were to be killed, and so the men were like, okay, I can't bear to lose children at all. We're not having any more children. The women said, absolutely not. First of all, have faith. Second of all, there are girls. Third of all, have faith. And so what the women would do is they would go, and Rashi says, quoting from Masal, they would beautify themselves in front of those mirrors in order to entice their husbands to become close to them, to have a relationship with them, and to produce the future of Klal Yisrael. Had that not happened, we wouldn't have had Moshe, wouldn't have had Geula, there would have been no Klal Yisrael, this whole Sefer wouldn't exist. Says God, that's why I want those mirrors in this Mishkan. Now, why would those mirrors be the ones that are used to build the Kiyor? Because they did with those mirrors exactly what they were supposed to do. They looked at a mirror and they could have seen themselves. They looked in those mirrors and they could have seen themselves. But instead, they chose to look past themselves and only utilize their physical beauty for the purposes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to continue on the Jewish people, to produce the next generation of the Jewish people, to keep them alive and create Geula. That's exactly what the Kiyor is about. Wash away your agendas, wash away your external perceptions, and see things for what they really are. Focus on what really matters. And that's why those mirrors are used to build the Kiyor. And that's why the Kiyor is the first avoda in the Beit HaMikdash and the Mishkan. Now I'm trying to recap two shiurim and add a third in one shiur. We're tight on time. But I want to get to the goal here. But there's no way to get to that goal without having this all of this foundation. And plus you got three shiurim for the price of one. Okay? Here's where I want to take it to the next step. That's often where we leave the shiur. We're only 28 minutes in. Usually that's a 45-minute shiur to a 50-minute shiur. Two 50-minute shiurim. And those, that stuff needs to be processed, but I want to take it one step deeper, and this is where I want to drive it home. Let's come back to our fundamental original question. Not just the narrative of Kitisa, but the narrative of Shmot. What is Kitisa doing here? Why is it in the middle of the theory of the Mishkan and the actualization of the Mishkan? What is it doing here? I think the answer is as follows, and it builds on everything that we've talked about. Let's take the B'nai Adam example. We go, and we want to meet the person who we're going to marry. So we go through the dating process, and we get to know them. And we date, and we date, and we date. And lo aleinu, some of us date, and date, and date. But eventually, kashek kriyat yamsuf, but eventually we find that person. And when that time comes, we fall head over heels in love with that person. They're everything that we think about. We're thinking about who they are, what they are, how much we care about them, how much we think we love them already. We're there. It's amazing. Nothing else in the world matters.
All of your friends who are dating that person who aren't talking to you anymore, they don't even remember they're not talking to you. They're just thinking about that person. Because they love them. They're going to marry them. And they come to the chuppah and they seal the deal. They go to the chuppah and they get married and they're ready to build their bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael. And I think that kitisa presents the fact that even that's not the end of the story. Because if we think about the way that the Mishkan is built, and we've talked about this in the past, the Mishkan has layers. The Mishkan has an Azara, and a Kodesh, and a Kodesh HaKadoshim. And each one is a deeper and deeper layer, and certain people are allowed in the Azara, the Kohanim are allowed in the Kodesh. But there's only one thing that stands in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What stands in the Kodesh HaKadoshim? The Aron with the Kruvim on top of it. Only the Kruvim. The Kruvim which Chazal tell us that one of them was in the image, one of them was representing, one of them was representing Klal Yisrael, and one of them was representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those are the only two things that stood in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It's the relationship between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. And when Klal Yisrael would do Ratzon Hashem, the Kruvim would gaze at each other lovingly. And when Bnei Yisrael wouldn't do Ratzon Hashem, the Kruvim would face away from each other. They would look away from each other. The centerpiece of the Kodesh HaKadoshim is a singular relationship between those two beings. That means that inside of each and every one of us, in our Kodesh HaKadoshim, there's only one other person who belongs in our Kodesh HaKadoshim. And nobody else. And that's our spouse. Nobody else belongs there. Nobody else goes there. Nobody else is allowed there on every level of being. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, there is a part of myself where there's one kruv inside and I'm desperately spending my life up until that point looking for my other kruv, looking for the other half of myself, to build that Kodesh HaKadoshim inside of myself. And nobody else belongs there. However, if nobody else belongs there, that means that nobody else belongs there. It means that every time I go out and I'm dating, and I meet this incredible person, there are some people who I think might be the one, and I let them into my Azara. And I might even really think that that person is the one, and I let them into my Kodesh. But Chas v'Sholom lo aleinu, on every level of being, we're not just talking physically here, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, my whole sense of self. Chas v'Sholom lo aleinu, we never, ever, ever want to let that person into our Kodesh HaKadoshim until after we get married. That's when we create that reality of Mishkan. That's when we go to build that bayit, but until that bayit exists, that person isn't allowed there. That is sacred space. That is space that is only available to my spouse when we're married together. That's it. And it's a thing to really spend time contemplating when dating, who to let in and how much to let them in, and to make sure that no matter what happens on every level of being, we don't talk about it enough. Everybody's so busy focusing in different places in high school and yeshivot and seminaries on Shomer Nagi and issues of physicality. Physicality, 100% true. But spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, those things are also true. You don't give your whole being away to anybody else that belongs to your spouse. But if that's true, if I'm right, and on this point I'm confident to say that I am, then that means that even the person who I know I'm going to marry, even when I stand with them under the chuppah, you know where that person has never entered? My Kodesh HaKadoshim. So who am I marrying? The simple answer is that I really don't 100% know. And it's a little bit of a frightening concept. A little bit of a frightening concept. That I don't know 100% the person who I'm getting married to. But that's the way it should be. I shouldn't know them. They haven't been able to enter that deepest chamber of myself, and I haven't entered that deepest chamber of them. I don't know them. I don't fully know the deepest essence of who they are. But I spent all this time thinking about them, obsessing over them. I'm head over heels about them. I forgot all of you existed because I've just been thinking about her. I don't even know who you are anymore. She's the only thing that matters to me. He's the only thing that matters to me. Despite that, I don't really know that other person yet. In which case, when I'm getting married, what I'm really getting married to is I'm getting married to my image of who that person is. I'm getting married to what I've built up in my mind, who I imagine that person to be. And that's not a bad thing. That's totally natural. That's totally normal. It's in fact the way it's supposed to be. And that's why when we date, we're supposed to talk about what we want our house to be like, what we imagine it to be like. But imagining what my house is like, partio truma and tetzava, where we imagine what the Mishkan is going to be like, where we hear about the Mishkan in theory, imagining what my life with this person is like is very different than actually waking up next to them every morning and seeing whether or not the toothpaste is open or closed. Whether or not they left the leftovers last night on the table or put them back in the fridge. What do they really care about? I didn't know you did that when you have 10 minutes free time. I didn't know that that's what you do with your free time. Because I haven't been with you every second. And that's only on the external levels, but I really don't... I suddenly realize, I don't really know. There's a whole nother you. There is a whole you that I don't know. I have this critical moment where in marriage, and I believe this is my understanding of this parsha, this is entirely my understanding, that there comes a point in time in a marriage, in everybody's marriage, where the image of the person that we married shatters. And that's Parshat Ki Tisa. Where the person doesn't live up to my image of the person. Because it was never really them. And then the question becomes, well, how do I go forward? What do I do? And that's laid out in this parsha as well. God gives us the worst case scenario. I have this image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Bnei Yisrael have an image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a God of Din, and that's not who God really is, but we can't deal with that. So God says, okay, fine. You can't accept me for who I am. I'm going to give you the worst case scenario, which by God is not fun. That would be wiping out the entire Jewish people. I would say that that's an intense divorce. It's a really intense divorce. And I don't take that lightly, and it's something which is a lot more prevalent in our day days, and But that's what happens. God says, worst case scenario, we're going to end this. There is no relationship between us. The end. That's the worst case scenario. That's a scenario that we want to avoid at all costs. And so one person steps forward who says, I don't accept. Who steps forward and says, I don't accept? Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, that's not good enough for me. No. If you're going to do that, take me out of this book. I want no part in this Sefer. I want no part in the Torah. I want no part in Sefer Shemot. I am not taking this Sefer to its conclusion unless you're going there with me. If you're going to end this relationship, take me out of here. Mecheni nami sifrecha. I have no interest in being in this book if that's how this ends. I don't care if you're going to rebuild for me. I have no interest. We need to resolve this. Why is it Moshe Rabbeinu who's able to resolve this problem, who can approach God and say, let's talk this out? What has Moshe Rabbeinu accomplished that nobody else has been able to accomplish? He actually speaks to God. He's the person who's come the closest to seeing God face to face. And wouldn't you know it, that pasuk's in our parsha. Following Chet HaEgel, source number 11. God spoke to Moshe face to face. This isn't necessarily in the context. It has its context in the Sefer, but it's not like it's almost thrown in here because it's essential to the parsha, not even because of the paragraph that it's in. That God speaks to Moshe face to face. He's the one who's able to see God for who He is as best as a human being can, and he challenges God, and he says that's not good enough. And you look to the whole next paragraph. The whole next paragraph is about the resolution of this issue. And the word panim is actually what is laced through the entire next few paragraphs. Moshe then goes forward and he says to God, in the midst of trying to fix Chet HaEgel and the disaster in the wake of Chet HaEgel, Hodieni na et drachecha ve'edacha. The next underline. Show me your ways. Let me see you for who you are. Moshe begs God to let him see him for who he is, to show the Jewish people who he is, so they can begin to repair that relationship. Pasuk Tedvav. Va'omari lav. Im ein panecha holchim al ta'alinu mizeh. If your face is not going to lead us through the desert, don't bother taking us out. Now, this is an interesting reference. We understand that this pasuk is actually linked back to a pasuk in Mishpatim. Why it's in Mishpatim is not for discussion for now. Where God seems to have slipped in, maybe past Moshe Rabbeinu at the time, I'm not sure, but Moshe only addresses it now, which is in source number 12, which is that God said in Parsha Mishpatim, Ki anochi sholeach malach lefanecha lishmorcha baderech laviecha lemakom asher achinoti. God says, I'm going to send an angel, and the angel, the malach, is the one that will guide you through the desert. And Moshe Rabbeinu now here says, nothing doing. You or bust. I think that's level 2, shlav bet. You could say, okay, fine. I don't know who you are. You don't know who I am. We're going to make this work, but I'll say we're going to make this work. With a malach. With a messenger. We've got lots of messengers these days. We'll lead parallel lives. And you'll shoot me a text, or you'll shoot me a WhatsApp, or you'll shoot me an email. We'll send each other messages about how to make sure that we can lead parallel lives and make this work. I'm not interested in figuring out who you are. I'm not interested in letting this end. So lead parallel lives. And my messenger will take you forward. We'll walk together, but we won't really know each other. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, uh-uh. No way. The only way I'm going, says Moshe Rabbeinu. But Yomer Elav, im ein panecha holchim al ta'alinu mizeh. Don't bother taking us forward. Not just that you need to be here. Not just that you need to be with this people. That's not enough. If your face isn't going to take us, al ta'alinu mizeh. Don't take us forward. And God, already seeing that coming, says, Moshe Rabbeinu was reiterating that in the previous pasuk, pasuk Yedalad. God says, Vayomer pana yelchu v'anichoti lach, my face will go with you. That's the goal. That's what we're trying to achieve. Is then to truly see each other. To finally enter into a relationship where we truly see each other for who we are. That's the only way to take it forward. Is to resolve, is to admit that we had an image of who each other was. Whether it's Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Klal Yisrael had this image of God in their minds, and it was false. It was an idol. It was false. It was not God for who truly was. Or whether it's in a relationship, in a marriage, we admit, okay, we don't know. We don't really know who the other person is. How are we going to go forward? Are we going to say, I can't believe who this person is. I don't even know who they are. Or we have the option of saying, which is what Moshe Rabbeinu is explaining here in these paragraphs after Chetah Egel, that the response in that moment in a marriage is, there are moments, but that critical moment in a marriage is, I don't know you. And that's amazing. I realize that you're so much more than this image that I was able to conjure up, that you're an infinite person. And I want to spend the rest of my life really getting to know you. I'm so excited by that. That's what the rest of my life is going to be about, is to understand who you are. That, and that's what Moshe Rabbeinu is making him show me your ways. Hareini na kivodecha, that's the next paragraph. This is the paragraph where God, where Moshe begs God, show me your ways, show me your face. And God has to say, okay, fine, but I'm God, so I can't show you my face, but I'll show you my back, and I'll show you the most of me that I can. Because we never fully understand the other, because everybody's infinite. Even our spouse will never fully understand them to the nth degree, because just like I'm infinite, she's infinite. Just like I'm infinite, he's infinite. And I'm going to keep working to get more and more and more, greater and greater and greater understanding of the person. That's the excitement of life. To really understand you for who you are. To build that Bayit Ne'eman v'Yisrael for real. That's Vayakal Pekudei. Truma Tetzav is the command on what the Mishkan ideally is. It's the theory of the Mishkan. It's the potential for the Mishkan. But we need to go through Kitisa and have our false image of God shattered. Then we can have two separate parshiot, because now it's a totally different Mishkan. Even though the words are similar, even though the dimensions are the same, it's a whole different Mishkan. Because I'm building a Mishkan with a God who I'm connected to, a God who I'm looking at, with God as He is, not God as I imagine Him to be. That's Vayakel Pekudei. And that's what allows source 14, the Sefer, to close. And finally, Vayechas Ha'anan et Ol Moed Ukvod Hashem Alei et HaMishkan. Then God really comes in. Because we're truly relating to Him as He is. That's what the Mishkan is about. One last source, and then we'll wrap everything together. Which is really a source that we saw before. I gave to you an incomplete version of Rashi about those Mar'ot Tzov'ot, about those mirrors that were used to build the Kiyor.
Let's take a look inside, understand the source, and then we'll close. Take it from the beginning of the underline. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Kabel, accept those mirrors. Ki elu chavavin alai min hakol, they're more precious to me than anything. Sh'al yidehem ha'amidu hanashim sfa'ot rabot b'mitzrayim. That was how the women created all of the leisure time. Now, what I said before is still true, but there's more to this Rashi. There's way more to this Rashi. Kishayu ba'alehem yagi'am be'avodat parech, when their husbands were just being oppressed by impossible work in Mitzrayim. Hayu alchot umolichot lahem ma'achal u'mishah, they would bring their husbands food and drink. Uma'achilototam, and they would feed them. Vinot lotam arot, and they would bring the mirrors. V'kolachat ro'e atzma im ba'ala, and they would each see each other with their spouse. They would together gaze in those mirrors. They would look past the physicality of each other and gaze at each other and see each other for who they truly were. And that's what brought them back together. Because they were two halves of one being. V'yoldot sham, and then they would... Yes. U'mi'aldot b'dvarim, and then they would draw their husbands to them with words. Lamar, Nina, and Mimcha, they would say, no, I'm more beautiful than you. No, I'm more beautiful than you. They would kid around with each other, as a husband and wife should do. U'mitochach m'v'yot l'ba'alien l'idei ta'avam, n'istakaku lahem m'vidabrod v'yoldot sham. And that's what brought them to have a physical relationship with each other and to produce children and produce the future of Klal Yisrael. Next underline. Here's what blew my mind last year when I hit this next part of this Rashi. That's why you have to read till the end. V'na'aseha kior mehem, and so we made the kior out of them. Now, it could have been for all the reasons that I said, and I think that it is for all the reasons that we discussed. But the Chazal see an even deeper reason within it. Shulashum shalom b'nish lishto. Not just because of seeing past themselves, because the kior and the mirrors were all about shalom bayit. The kior is all about true shalom bayit. How so? It says Rashi, seemingly out of nowhere, but fits perfectly into what we talked about. Lashkot mimayim shebitocho et shekanala ba'ala v'nistira. In a case where there was kina and stira, then it fixes everything. What is kina and stira? What is that talking about? Asota. Asota. When a woman is accused of going and being with another man and breaking that bond of marriage, she's marched to Yerushalayim, to the Beit HaMikdash, and eventually the water that she drinks is water from the kior. What do we hope doesn't happen to the woman? We hope she doesn't blow up. I mean, that's the idea. We don't want that to happen, right? But we assume that's not going to happen. We assume that after all we put her through, that if she's going to drink those waters, because she knows that she is totally in the clear and that her husband is wrong. And so when she drinks that water and nothing happens, what does her husband then realize in this deeply broken relationship? That his image of his wife was false. He didn't see her for who she truly was. His whole picture of her was distorted. His whole picture of her was deranged. She was a faithful wife to him. She may have done something wrong. She shouldn't have gone into that house to begin with. But his whole picture of her is totally distorted. And then this water from this kior, from these mirrors, allows him to finally see his wife for who she truly is. And allow them to come back together and rebuild a bayit ne'aman b'Yisrael. That's the depth of the kior, even beyond what we said before. That's what all of this story is about. It's about, this whole parsha is about panim, it's about seeing God for who He is. Do we see God? That's what Avodah Zarah is about. And we can go more into that another time, into how that fits into actual Avodah Zarah in those times. But that's what Avodah Zarah is about. Are we serving an image of ourselves? Are we serving our image of God, or are we serving God as He is? When I'm getting married, do I recognize that at the beginning I'm probably going to just see the image of the person who I married? Am I willing to get over myself and what I want for me, and to love her for her, to love him for him, and to be excited about that? And like Moshe Rabbeinu says in that paragraph, in verse number 11, that whole amazing, just read that paragraph and soak it in, this mystical, incredible paragraph, where he's begging Kadosh Baruch Hu, show me your face, show me your ways, let me understand you, let B'nai Yisrael understand you for who you are for real. That's how we can go forward. Ask me a question quickly. I don't want to push this. Kitisa, the very end of Kitisa.
No, we won't go there. We'll leave it where it is. That's what this parsha is about. That's something which I hope you'll take with you, both in terms of the narrative of Sefer Shmot, the narrative of our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and again, the narrative of our very lives. And while, again, this may not necessarily be relevant to you in this moment, my hope is that there were moments in my life where I sat in Shirim when I was your age, in college, and heard certain things about marriage that stuck with me, that changed the way that my marriage functions. I hope that this stays with you. That it's okay to not let a person... Not okay. You need to make sure that you let no one into your Kodesh HaKadoshim on any level as you're dating. That when you get married, that means they've never been in there and you've never been into theirs, and that you don't know exactly who they are, and that the beauty and the glory of marriage for an entire lifetime is Vayakal Pekudei, is letting that image shatter, seeing the person for who they are for the first time as an infinite being that you never knew, and then building that forever. And that so too our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Recognize that our image of a Kaddish Baruch Hu that we have is likely incomplete and at worst false. To let that image shatter and spend our whole lifetime getting to a Kaddish Baruch Hu for who he is, for seeking God's face. Bezrat Hashem, in our own lives, we should see our spouse's face and we should build a Bayit Ema Yisrael. And also throughout Jewish history and in our own lives, see HaKadosh Baruch Hu for who he truly is and be able to build the Beit HaMikdash from here at B'Yaminu.